Hello, welcome everybody. This is the sixth lecture of the Machine Learning for Green Horse course. Are there any questions before we start? This is a great moment. You have me to answer any questions you would like. No questions? Then let me start with lecture. But by all means, please don't hesitate to interrupt me whenever you want to. Before we get to the slides of this lecture, I wanted to go through the metrics which we talked on the previous lecture, because there are some extensions there. So we talked about binary classification and that we have used accuracy so far to perform the evaluation. However, in some cases we might be interested in just the positive cases, whether we have said that something is positive or whether it's the denoted as positive in the data, but we might care only about this one specific class, which we call positive, and just disregard the next one. And before we came, or in order to come up with such a metric, we considered the confusion matrix. The confusion matrix is a matrix which contains like all the possible existing target labels and the predicted labels, right? And then we had true positives and false positives, where false positives meant that we predicted positive, but it was false, right? True negative and false negative, so we predicted negative and it was false. And accuracy is just the whatever we did correctly, that is diagonal, divided by the sum of the whole matrix. Then, in order to come up with the metrics which are interested in positive examples, we defined two of them: precision, which was how, like, what was the rate of the correct prediction in all the predicted examples. So, if we say that something is positive, what really is the case that it's so? And recall, and recall told us how much of the really positive examples we can find by using our classifier. And these metrics went against each other. And by went against each other, I mean that if we change the threshold of the binary classifier, then I don't know, if instead of 0.5, we would increase the threshold, then we would generate less positive examples. So our precision would probably increase. However, our recall would decrease because we generate only a few examples. On the other hand, if the threshold decreases, then our recall increases and our precision probably goes down. And because these two things, like it was possible to optimize for precision, optimize for recall, we wanted one metric which was just a combination of all these, of both of these. The combination was the harmonic mean. So the final formula looks like this. It's 2 times precision times recall divided by precision plus recall. And if we want to formulate it in the terminology of the confusion matrix, then we can take the formula for precision, we can take the formula for recall, and then we just sum them, like the denominator and the denominator, independently. This is of course a weird operation, adding two fractions by independently adding numerator and the denominator, but that's exactly what will happen when we compute the harmonic mean of these two numbers. So if we looked at the confusion matrix, this F1 score can be computed by considering twice the true positives and divided by twice the true positives plus false negative plus false positives. And even the weighted version can work for it. What we didn't talk about was how to use F-score in multi-class classification. For example, in the thyroid competition, we could have had the negative class, which means, okay, the patient is fine. And instead of just the positive one, which means that there is some malfunction in the thyroid function. We could have like a hyperfunction and a hypofunction. So we could have had multiple classes. So if we want to use F-score in this situation, then we expect one of the classes to be the negative one, the one which we generally ignore, and then the different kinds of the positive classes, so the rest of the cases. And for each of these positive classes, we will compute the same confusion matrix as in the binary case. So we like consider each of these positive classes independently, get the counts of the true positives and so on. And then we need to combine these results into just one number. And generally there are two possibilities how to do it. And they are called micro averaging and macro averaging. In the micro averaging, the result is sometimes called just micro F1. Means that we first sum the true positives, false positives and false negatives, and then compute the final F-score. This way, the frequency of the individual classes is taken into account, right? Because if one of these classes is three times as frequent as the other one, then it will have three times as many true positives as the other one, which means in the final F-score, this class will have larger weight. It will be more important. That's why it's called a micro averaging, it's probably in English. It means that we average the individual examples. That's what the micro means. Like we are looking at the individual examples, and that's what we average. And the other possibility is to do the macro averaging, probably. And by macro averaging, I mean that we look only at the classes. We don't look at the specific examples. So we compute the F-score. This should be H. We compute the F-score of the individual classes independently, and then we compute the unweighted average of the resulting F-score. So that's why it's macro averaging, because we just average the classes by themselves independently on how frequent they were, right? So this time the frequency of the classes is ignored. And then we talked about the receiver operating characteristics or ROC curve, which was very similar to the precision and recall. However, it was useful in cases where we are also interested in the true negatives, right? In the precision recall curve, we don't look at the last bottom right corner, while we may want to do so. Because we might care about these. So in this ROC curve, we consider the sensitivity or recall, or also true positive rate, which means how well, how much of the true positives we can actually discover. So that's the same. But then the other quantity will not be precision, right? Precision would be this. And once again, we would just ignore the true negative. So instead, let's focus on the cases which are really negative, like their targets are negative. And we can come up with two different measures. One which would be like an analog to recall would probably be the true negatives divided by true negatives plus false positives, which means how much of the negatives can we actually find. This is called specificity sometimes, and in the context of medical testing, it means how specific the conclusion is. So if the conclusion says positive, the conclusion says negative, then the other way around. If the conclusion says positive, okay, so now I've got quite stuck in it. So let me start again. First, let's talk about the false positive rate, which is what we use in the ROC curve. The false positive rate tells us if you say that something is positive and it's not, like how likely it is for all the negatives, right? So if you have the cases which are really negative, and then you say that for some of them that it's a positive, so that's a mistake. It's a false positive, and this false positive rate tells you how frequent this situation actually is. So what is the ratio of the examples which are negative, which you denote as positive. And this value, so it's FP false positives divided by false positives plus true negative. And this value is 1 minus specificity, and the specificity tells you how well you can discover the true negatives. So if there is a test and it says the negative, then how much of the real negative cases you will discover. So that's why it's specific, like how specific the test is, if it says negative, whether it's true or not. Yep. This weird name is just a historical one, because computations like this were actually used during the Second World War for radars. So when they tried to discover a plane, then they were in a similar situation and they had some kind of a response. And the question is whether it was strong enough to say that it is actually an enemy airplane or not. Right, and then there are various cases which you want to consider, whether, like, what is the chance that it will actually be plain and you won't say that it's not, or what the chance that you will say that it's not a plane and it actually will be. So they, like, looked at these curves of, like, and decided which threshold to use to somehow behave in the best possible way. So that means we have quite a lot of metrics which we can compute from the binary confusion matrix. So I tried to put all of them here on this slide. So this is the confusion matrix, and around are various metrics which we consider. Here, for example, is precision, true positive divided by true positive over false positives. I also have a graphical illustration of the computation, which is this image. The red one means that what we are interested in is this upper left corner, so a true negative, like, and we divide it by the true negative and the false positive. So these two blue squares means we are using these two ones of the binary confusion matrix in the denominator, and we are not using the predicted negatives at all, right? So that's precision. Recall, it's like this. So we look at the target positives and are interested in how much of these are actually true positives. For the negatives, we can have both the specificity and the positive rate, which I got stuck into on the previous slide. In the false positive rate, we look at the rate of the false positives with respect to all negative examples is, and with the specificity is the other way around. So how many of the negatives we can actually discover by using the test. Then the F-score takes twice the true positives and divided by all the values except for the true negative, and the accuracy uses the full matrix and computer diagonal divided by all the examples. So this is just so that we have a reasonable overview of all the metrics which might be useful. I'm not saying that these are all of them. You can probably define several other analogs, but these are the ones which we somehow consider in machine learning. Yep. So this was just a quick sum up from the previous lecture. Now let's get to today's one. Today we will talk about kernel methods, and one of the most useful kernel methods is support vector machine. We won't finish the SVMs today, definitely, and it will probably take us two lectures to get through them. We will do, like, at the beginning, we will need to think about how we will formulate the algorithms, and we will change views on algorithms and so on. So please don't get lost. It's better to ask if you are not sure what's happening than just thinking, well, maybe you'll catch it up. So we will build up on a lot of things today. So if you are lost, then please don't hesitate to stop me and ask. assume that we want to perform linear regression. We have d input features, but we want to consider not just the raw input features, but all the various combinations. So specifically, we want to use the linear features, like the features where the individual input features are just by themselves, but also quadratic features with all possible pairs of the input features, and also cubic features where we consider all possible triplets of the input features. We can easily create a mapping, which we will call feature map phi, which given the input features will generate this vector. And the size of this vector is 1 plus d squared plus d to 3. So it's r of asymptotically d cubed, right? For simplification, I'm generating both x1, x2, and x2, x1. It will make some math easier. So consider this more to be an illustrative example than a real application, because in the real application you would not generate the x2, x1. Yep. So, well, we can do it. We can use this feature mapping and then just run the linear regression. In the linear regression, we would use an SGD update. If we trained with an SGD, we would do an SGD update. And what the SGD update looks like? Well, it looks like this. It's the target minus our prediction, right? This is what we would predict, the scalar product of the weights and the feature vector corresponding to x. Compute the difference with t, multiplied by this feature vector corresponding to x, and multiplying by the learning rate and adding to w, right? Maybe you would be used to saying that we should subtract the gradient and then say w t phi t minus t, right? But if we don't like minuses, we can just solve the order in the gradient and be happy. So this is an update which we would do in an SGD. Now, how much time do we need to perform this update? Well, we need to compute phi and then compute the phi x times the weights. And this takes time cubic in D, right? Because that's the size of the parameters and that's the size of phi. However, we can do better under some circumstances, specifically if the number of training data is small, then we can perform this update significantly faster. We can do it in time n times d. So for n, which is better than d squared, we can actually get some savings. So it won't be all about savings, but that's one of the motivations to show you what's happening. So in order to improve our performance, we start by realizing or noting that the parameters w can be written as a linear combination of the input features. Well, why it should be true? Well, we can prove it by induction. So assume that we start with all zeros. Well, zero is a linear combination of anything with coefficient with zero coefficient. So that's fine. It's true at the beginning. And then we will show that this feature or this property holds even through the SGD update. So assuming that the weights can be written as a linear combination of the input features times some factor beta I, then after one SGD update, right, that's what we wrote here, what we get that the new version of weights is the old version of weights plus alpha times the gradient of the negative loss function, and we can rearrange this easily to see that the result is once again a linear combination of the input features. And whenever we have to really see that that's the case, I'm thinking how to do it. Yeah, okay. So let's do it like this. We will consider all these phi's here, and we have W here, but by the induction, we assume that it's linear combination of these input features. So we that's why these beta are here, because this beta I phi xi will generate W. And then the rest of the expression is already a multiple of phi xi, so we just keep it here. And now you can see that the result is once again a linear combination of the input features, and these beta i's, these factors belonging to these input features, has changed to beta i plus alpha times the ith target minus the prediction for the input xi, right? This is just the content of this parenthesis. After we substitute for w here, we get the following update. The beta I is changed by adding the ti minus. Now we have the scalar product of the phi xi t, right? That's this part, times the beta j phi xj. So beta j is here, phi xj is here. And this update is completely equivalent to performing this SGT update. So we can formulate the algorithm in both formulations, either with the parameters W or with the betas. Right. And these two formulations, they have names. So up until now, we have always used the weights formulation, and that's sometimes called the primal formulation. And that's a parametric model, right? It's got fixed number of parameters, which equals to the dimensionality of the input features. And that's how we did things up until now. However, this allows us to reformulate the linear regression in the so-called dual formulation, where instead of the parameters W, we have these parameters beta, right? Instead of having a fixed number of parameters, we have one scalar factor for each input example. So in this dual formulation, the algorithm is actually a non-parametric. Right, we talked about parametric and non-parametric models on the next lecture, and the non-parametric ones, they don't have a fixed number of parameters. They can be substantially larger, but it's not fixed. And that's exactly what happens in this dual formulation. We have weight for each of these examples. This allows us, let me formulate the whole algorithm in this dual formulation. So we want to run the linear regression. We have inputs, we have targets, we have a learning rate. Now, instead of having a fixed number of parameters, right, in the primal formulation, we would have weights, which would be a lot of numbers, because this phi generates a lot of numbers. So it would be 1 plus d squared plus d cubed. But instead, we have betas for every training example. Now we will pre-compute all possible scalar products of the training data. So we will consider all pairs of xi, xj, and the scalar product of the feature map applied on them. And we will store these as chi, as k, probably k xi xj, right? When we consider this to be a matrix, then k ij is equal to this. So this is just some pre-computing step which will be useful. And now we will train. So repeat until we have converged. Assuming that we have performed a full gradient update, meaning we said, okay, this W is W minus or maybe plus alpha times. And now we would have the gradient of the mean of all of a gradient of all the examples. Right, so there would be a loss. Yeah, so this is just a symbolic representation, but generally, if it would be an SGD update with a batch size of whole training data, then by using this formulation, we can achieve the same result by updating all the betas to the value which we computed here. So the final model is still the same after either these or these updates. They just have a different characteristic performance-wise. So this is the version where we update all the betas at the same time, which correspond to using a full gradient update. Alternatively, when we would be performing the SGD for a single example, so this would be just, maybe I shouldn't just delete it, but if this would be just minus alpha times the gradient of the loss of one example, then this update corresponds to updating one of these betas. This is like an interesting distinction because in the parametric models, where even if you are computing the gradient with respect to one example, you can update all the parameters. Right? Because depending on what features does this example have, well, they will change, either be increased or decreased or something. However, in the dual formulation, when we want to update the weights using the gradient of one feature vector, then in this formulation, we will change only the coefficient which belongs to the features of the corresponding example which we are processing. So in this dual formulation, we update only one number whenever we are computing the gradient with respect to one example, right? So we just like use this random permutation as usually, and then we update the parameters by changing just one number. Once we have trained the algorithm, we can perform the prediction by computing the following. We decided with the people on the previous lecture to change the notation. They were confused by the x and xi. So the prediction for a given z is computed as usual by computing the scalar product of the weights and the features of the input. However, we have this dual formulation, so we don't have a set of weights. Instead, we have one weight for each of the training examples. So what we do is we compute these scalar products of all training data times the input at hand. And for each of these scalar products, we have weight beta I, which we can use. So now, as for the time complexities, so performing a full SGD update, or how much time it would take? It would take. Let me write it here. The primal formulation, right, and then the dual one. So for training an epoch. So in the primal formulation, we would need time n times d cubed, right? Because this is the number of features. And this is the number of examples which we need to process in an epoch. In the dual formulation, we need to pay, we need to use time linear for each for one beta. However, we also need some pre-computation. The pre-computation is to getting this matrix of scalar products, and that one takes n squared d. Right, so this we do once, and then we do a lot of these. So if there are e epochs, we have these complexities. And then for inference, in the primal formulation, it's simple. It will just be d to 3, right? Because we just need to compute the phi and multiply it by the weights. In the dual formulation, we will need to spend time n times n times complexity of computing the scalar product. So if this is again d to 3, then it will not be any better. However, if we can do this quickly, and we will see how we can do this in a d time, then it will be substantially better. Yep, so not many of you were able to stay here until now. So this is a good time to ask if you have any questions or something. No questions, everything is fine. So we have got these two views on the same algorithm. Either we work with the weights, right, a fixed set of weights, or we work with numbers such that we have like one parameter for each training data. And we do the same thing, we perform an SGD, but either by updating the weights or updating the coefficients for betas, for the individual examples. So we will get to, let's do it even now. Imagine that this scale product would somehow be able to measure distances. That doesn't necessarily always need to be true, but humor me and assume that it's the case. So let's say that this scalar product somehow is a distance. If that would be so, then what does this prediction means? Well, this part tells you, okay, so if the input z is very close to the example xi, then we use this weight beta I on the result, and the closer we are to xi, the more of the beta i we actually use, and the farther we are, the less influence it will have. So in a sense, this is similar to the KNN algorithm, right? We have an example z, and we consider not just the k nearest neighbors, we just consider all possible neighbors which we have, measure the similarity to them at this part, and then for the ones which are very similar, they will influence the results more, while the examples which are not that similar will influence the result less. And as for the influence, well, we have a trained value which tells us how much a single training example will influence the results. So in the case of the KNN, this beta would probably be the target value itself, right? And this part would tell us, okay, so we are close to this example, so we will use the the target of that example. So I'm not saying it's perfect analogy, but it's very similar. And now, if this should be any useful, we need to evaluate this scalar product quickly. But luckily, it is possible to do it. And in our case, where this phi are these cubic features, then what does this scalar product looks like? Well, first we multiply the features with zero input dimensions, like just ones. Then we multiply the input features of the one example and the input features of the second example. So we have sum over I of xi, zi. Then we want to multiply the xi, xj, like the pairs of features or the cubic features of the one input and the zi, zj, the cubic features of the other example, and the same for the triplets, for the cubic features. And the important observation is that we don't need to spend quadratic time to compute this sum. Instead, we might first compute the sum of xi, zi, so xi as x1, z1 plus x2, z2, and so on until xn, zn, or maybe xd, zd, squared, so times the same parentheses, xd, zd. And what the result looks like? Well, the result contains the xi, zi times xj, zj for all possible a's and j's. Like we choose the one term in the first parenthesis or bracket parenthesis. Then we choose one term in the second one, combine them together. So we get all possible quadratic combinations. So we can compute this quadratic sum by computing just the linear sum and then computing the square. These are not vectors, these are just numbers. So computing a square is very trivial. And the same trick also works for the cubic feature. So instead of really going through all possible combinations of over these d input features, we can just compute the scalar product, just the linear sum, and then compute to 3, right? So whole scalar product can be computed in time, which is OD, linear, with the input. Even if doing it in the primal formulation would require D to 3 time. So these values, this is the only way how we actually need to use the phi feature map. We will use it to denote, or we will denote the result, this scalar dot product of the feature map supplied to these individual of two input values. We will denote it as a kernel. So the kernel of two vectors is just the scalar product in the space where this feature map phi is projecting the inputs. And then instead of actually specifying or defining phi, we will instead just define the kernel, right? We will just say how we will compute this value without actually caring much about what the mapping phi would actually be. There is some non-trivial theory behind kernel construction. So how to construct kernels which actually correspond to some feature mapping phi. And there was a time in machine learning where the kernel methods were the best ones, the best available in the arsenal of the machine learning scientists. However, it's not the case anymore nowadays. So I won't bother you with the whole theory. Instead, I will show you the two or three most frequently used kernels. So one kernel is something which we have already seen. It's called a polynomial kernel of degree d. Also, it's called a homogeneous polynomial kernel, and it's computed by computing the scalar products in the original space, and then computing the power to d. And what I claim is that it corresponds to a feature map which generates all combinations of exactly d input features. So if we created the polynomial features of order exactly d, and then computing the scalar product, then that's exactly what we get when we compute it like this. So how, what, why is that the case? It's similar as in this previous example, right? So when we compute this scalar product and then multiply it to 3, then the result contains all possible triplets, where the first element is from the first parenthesis, the second from the second, and the third from the third parenthesis. So it will contain all possible combinations of xi, xj, xk. The only tricky thing is that normally this phi mapping would probably not generate both x1, x2, and x2, x1. Right? But that's exactly what I did in my first example. So here we probably want to avoid it. So to show what the feature map actually looks like, which corresponds to this kernel, we need to deal with this repeat. So I don't have the computation yet in slide. So instead, I will show you in this paper. So assume that our feature mapping projects into this space. The individual dimensions correspond to ways how we can choose d elements out of the k features, right? So these are the input features, and each dimension corresponds to one d tuple, like one way how we can choose d of the input features, and then it will generate the value which corresponds to the multiplication of these d features, and then there will be some constant factor. What you probably know is that when you have k numbers and compute them to d, you will, using this multinomial or binomial theorem, get the result which contains all the possible d tuples, d combinations of the input axis, and each is multiplied by this multinomial coefficient, which tells you in how many ways you can actually select these axes from the parentheses. So if you have, for example, x1 to 3, right? So let me create a new one, right? So if we have parentheses x1 plus something times x1 plus something times x1 plus something, then x2, x1 to 3, we can choose only in one way, right? We need to choose x1 here, x1 here, and x1 here. If instead we are interested in x1, x2, x3, then we can choose it in 6 possible ways, right? We can choose x1 here, x2 here, x3 here, or x3 here, x2 here, or the x2 one should have come from this middle or from the last parenthesis. So there are actually 6 ways in how we can choose this. So that's exactly what this multinomial coefficient is taking care of. Therefore, if we want to, we will use the same fact, and the compute this value, which is what we want, by projecting into these individual terms, and therefore we need to have this multinomial coefficient here as a constant, and also a square root, because we will be multiplying two like applications of this feature map phi on two different inputs, which means that we will get two of the same coefficients, right? They will get there from two different places. So that's why the square root is there, so that it will just cancel each other, right? So when we have phi of x times phi of z, then for one of these combinations of x1 to n1 times xd to nd, one of these phis will give us a square root of d over n1 times nd. So that comes from one of these phis, and then from the second of these phis we will get once again the square root of d over n1 nd. Right, so these two will just combine together, and we will be able to say that the sum over all the dimensions of this is actually x dz to d. That's exactly what we wanted, because this is what our kernel looked like. So that's the homogeneous polynomial kernel. And sorry, I just created too much slides. It might be in practical that we have generated exactly the features of order three, right? Usually we would probably want to get the features, like the original input features, then the quadratic features, and then the cubic features. So in order to do so, we would like the polynomial kernel of degree at most D, not equally D. And these are also called non-homogeneous polynomial kernels. So non-homogeneous because there are also these smaller orders there. And we can actually get it using one simple trick by adding plus one into this definition. Like, why does it work? Because when we have this value to d, then it is actually gamma times xdz to d times 1 to 0, plus there would be gamma times x to z d minus 1 times 1 to 1, and with d over 1, and so on and so on, right? So what I'm doing is I'm saying that x plus, or that a plus b to d is just the sum d over I, a to I, b to d minus I, right? I want to apply it on these two numbers, which means that the result will contain, maybe I should have done it from the beginning, d over I and the gamma times x times z to I times 1 to d minus I. Right, so we can just ignore this part. So we know that by adding this plus one, we were able to get there all possible homogeneous kernel with the same or smaller order. So we can easily, so we get also the terms which corresponds to the smaller or lesser degrees. However, so this is fine for the cubic features. We can get some performance improvement, but the real important thing is that we can also use the so-called Gaussian kernel or RBF kernel. The RBF is RBF stands for radial basis function. The basis function means like a function which we use in a feature construction, and radial means that it depends only on distances. So what the Gaussian kernel looks like? Well, for a given vectors of x and z, we subtract them, we compute the square root of their norm, and we compute e to minus this value. So this is the important part of the Gaussian probability density function, right? So this is in fact the shape of that will be the usual bell-shaped curve with this parameter gamma which acts in a sense as a variance, but in the opposite way, right? So the gamma tells us how strong should we consider the distances, right? If the distances decrease by one, how much should this be reflected by the similarity? So depending on gamma, we can make the function to look like this, or to look like this, right? It's not normalized to one, so it's always one when x is equal to certain, then decreases, or I should say gamma. It's always one. So this is a very special kernel, which has been very successful in many applications. And what is interesting about it, that it can actually act like a similarity measure, right? Exactly because of how this computation works, we get the highest value for the input value itself. And then the farther we are, the smaller the value is. And using this, we can return back to our kernel linear regression. So this computation, right, that's actually the kernel of x, I, and z, exactly allows us to interpret the result as versions of KNN regression on steroids, because we consider all possible input data, not just the k nearest ones. We measure the distance somehow to them, the similarity, and then we use this similarity to multiply this beta I, which is the learned parameter telling us how much does this I training example contribute or should contribute to the final result. This exponential, the Gaussian or RBF kernel, corresponds to a scalar product in an infinite dimensional space. So we cannot actually simulate this by any parametric method easily, because the parametric method would need to have infinite number of weights, which is a bit funny. Why is it so? Well, when you look at this expression, then let's say that I will just write there, I will just ignore the gamma. So we have something like this, right? And this square of the distance can be written as x squared minus epsilon squared plus the scalar product of x and z, right? And this is the important thing is the e to the scalar product of x and z, or there should have been a 2 here. So let me allow to divide this by 2 and then have half here and half here. I don't know if you recall, but e to z can be computed. I'm sorry, this should have been that. E to a can be computed by an infinite sum of a to k divided by k factorial for k from 0 to infinity. So we can write all this as a big sum of k from 0 to infinity. And here we have the x, t, z to k divided by k factorial times this thing. Now, what I will try to do is I will try to push these inside of this parenthesis. So what will happen? We still have the sum. Now there will be this x, t, z to k here. Now what will have to be here as well, there will have to be here the epsilon of minus x half squared, and we need to take the kth root of it, so I'll just say 2k, and the same with the epsilon. And we also have this k factorial here, so I'll say square root of k factorial times square root of k factorial, like this. And so each of those are actually polynomial kernels, right? That's what the polynomial kernel, the homogeneous one, looks like. So there's a scalar product here and some constant factor. It's very specific in our case, but it's just a number. So this RBF kernel, in fact, combines all polynomial kernels, like polynomial kernels of all the orders, and they are weighted implicitly by this constant. So probably the higher the order, the smaller the weight, the smaller the contribution. So even if there are infinitely many polynomial features here, or the features with infinite order, that their weights go to zero, so that the scalar product in this space still converges, right? So this Gaussian kernel is just a combination of all polynomial features combined with some specific weight, and it can be interpreted as a similarity. So are there any questions, ideas, comments? I think. Is everything fine? Hopefully, it seems fine. So this was the kernelized linear regression. First thing what we did is we used this dual formulation, which allowed us to look at the, not at the weights, but at like parameters, each belonging to one example. And this view allowed us to use not just the original input features, but some more advanced features constructed by this feature mapping phi. And in order to use this phi, it was enough only to have a kernel which can actually compute the scalar product in the space where this feature map phi is projecting. And there are some interesting kernels which can be evaluated efficiently, but they are very expressive, so they allow us to represent non-linear combinations of the input features. That's what we did. Now, this was just the introductory example or introductory assignment, introductory task for to demonstrate the kernel usage. And now let's get to the really interesting example, which are the super vector machines. The super vector machines are also a non-parametric model, which will be able to use some kernels. But it will be a binary classification algorithm. So consider, again, the binary classification task. Well, the perceptron algorithm, it guaranteed finding some separating hyperplane if it existed. That's what it did. For linearly separable points, it finds some the separating hyperplane. The problem is that it found some, and then it stopped. It couldn't improve, it couldn't generate a better one. With the logistic regression, we try to find one which improves the, which maximizes the probability of the data. And with SVMs, we will try to find the one with maximum margin. The margin of the classifier, that's the distance to the of the closest point to the decision boundary. So when we have this decision boundary, and consider distances of various points with respect to it. Then the one which is the closest, then the distance to it is called the margin. And the idea is that the one boundary with the maximum margin should be probably preferred, because if we find a decision boundary with a very small margin, then it is unnecessarily close to one of these examples, right? If instead we choose the one with the maximum margin, then it would be the furthest apart from all the examples. So it would be, in a sense, be the most general one, because it would go as far from all existing points as possible. So that's why we want this maximum margin hyperplane. And in this two-dimensional example, you can see that even if there would be a large number of the training data, then only three points actually decide what the maximum margin decision boundary will look like, right? They are defined by these three points, and now we cannot improve the margin anymore, because that would put one of these three points inside inside the margin, right? Inside the area which we want to be kept clear. One way how you can look at the margin is that you are actually building a road, right? And you want it to be as wide as possible. So you want to like put as much concrete, like to have the widest road possible, so that all the examples of one class are on one side and the examples of the other class are on the other side. So once again, assume that we have a data set and the targets. The targets will be the plus and minus one, similar to the perceptron algorithm. We will have a linear model again, using these features generated by this feature mapping file. This feature mapping will generate non-linear features, so then we will just do the linear thing, and we hope that we will be also able to process the non-linearly separable example. That's similar to what the neural networks do, right? They learn this non-linear mapping, and then we do just the last linear part by ourselves. We will denote the bias explicitly, because we will need to consider it specifically. We already know that the distance of a point from the decision boundary can be computed by looking at the prediction of the model, taking the absolute value, right? Generally, the zero is the decision boundary, then one side are the positive values, so the second one are the negative ones. And the larger the number is, the further apart we are from the decision boundary. And if we divide it, this distance by the size of the W, of the weight vector, which is just a normal to the decision boundary, then that's exactly the distance. Now, this absolute value can be taken care of by realizing that once we have found the classifier, then the prediction for the positive class will be greater than zero. For the negative class, it will be smaller than zero, right? That's what we want. We want to generate possible positive values for the positive cases and negative values for the negative cases. And this should be minus one, right? So we can say that this, that, or we can realize that t times y xi is actually positive or equal to zero if it is exactly on the decision boundary, right? Once we have trained successfully, of course. Therefore, if we want to maximize the margin, what we do, we try to find such weight and bias parameters that the distance to the closest point is as large as possible. So the distance to the point I is this ti times the prediction of the model, xdw plus beta, Oh, this should have been xi, sorry. Right, and we want to consider the smallest one, the closest point, and that's what we want to maximize. The problem is that this is difficult to optimize directly because we have some very non-linear function with this minimum inside, which is difficult to deal with. So instead, we reformulate our function, which we, our I don't know optimum function or our goal function in the following way. When we multiply the weights and biases by constant, it doesn't change the classes which the model predicts, but it changes the distances, right? The if you look just at the y, x, then the it doesn't really return the distances, it returns the distances with respect to the length of the w. So if we multiply w and beta, nothing will change on this prediction except that it will be larger or smaller by the given factor. So it is possible to actually scale this bias and weights so that the point closest to the decision boundary will give us just one or minus one. So we can actually say, okay, let's add a condition that the closest point will get us exactly the distance of one. The other ones, of course, hope will get larger, and this will influence the scalar product, which will be used, like it will influence the size of the W and B. So then we can simplify our goal function to the following one. We will maximize the one over the size of the margin times one, right? Because we know that all of these values are at least one. So the smallest one of them is exactly one. So we want to maximize this one over W, given that all points have the distance of at least one from the decision boundary. Now, when we are maximizing one over the W, we can also minimize the, like this means we want this length, this size to be as small as possible, so we can minimize it directly without computing one over, and we can also minimize the square root easily because it will change the values of W, but it won't change the size of the margin, so it's fine to do it. And this square root, the square, and this 1/2 will be useful for computing the derivatives. So what we have done is we have avoided this minimum at the expense of adding some constraint. Now, we have already talked about how to perform constraint optimization, how to incorporate the constraints that some function g is equal to zero. But now we would like to also include the inequality constraints that some function is greater or equal to zero, some inequality constraint, because that's exactly what we came up with. So to incorporate it, we will use a very similar idea as in the Lagrange multipliers, right? We start by forming a Lagrangian of the function which we want to maximize and lambda times gx, which is the inequality constraint. And now, instead of just looking for the maximum at the border of this potato, we now also include the inside of the potato, right? That's a new thing. Now, consider the maximum which we are searching. Generally, we can either find the maximum inside the potato or exactly on the boundary or on the boundary. So let's deal with these two cases individually. First, inside of the potato. When we are inside of the potato, then the gx, the constraint, is strictly larger than zero, and we say that it's inactive. While if we find the maximum on the border itself, when the gx is zero, when the constraint is at its own boundary, then it's said to be active. The reason for those is that for the inactive case, for the case inside the boundary, the maximum needs to be the maximum of the original function f. The g function, the constraint doesn't influence the value in any way, right? Because there is a lot of points around this maximum which also fulfill this constraint that the g is larger than zero. So it doesn't constrain the neighborhood of the point in question. So that's why it's called inactive, because it means it needs to be the maximum of the original function f. So in this case, we say that this Lagrange multiplier must be a zero, which means this is just not here, and the maximum of the Lagrangian of the function needs to be the original maximum, the maximum of the original function. So that was the inactive case inside the potato. Now, for the active case at the border of the potato, well, we have done this already in the Lagrange multipliers case, but it's a bit different than it was before. What we came up with was that this f function must be orthogonal to the decision boundary so that this is maximum, right? And we knew that the gradient of g was pointing inside, the gradient of f needs to be in the same line, and if these two were collinear, then we have found our local maximum. This is nearly the same case as before. However, this time it's also important in which direction does this f function points, the gradient of f, right? So this is gradient of f, this is gradient of g. So if the function f points inside the potato, what does it mean? Well, it means that when we are at the boundary and go small step in the direction of the gradient of f, then f will increase. So this value is not really a maximum, because we can step inside the potato to increase the value of the objective function f. This wasn't possible in the equality constraint case, right? We couldn't go anywhere from the border, so this was maximum before, but it's not the maximum now. The only case where we get maximum is then when the f points outside of the potato, right? Because we still cannot go in this direction, we cannot leave the potato. So even if this point is not the maximum of the original function, it's a maximum of constraint problem, because we cannot go outside of this g, and this function f is the highest locally here. So the difference to the previous case is that this Lagrange multiplier must be positive. Because if it would be negative, it means this f is pointing inwards, and that means it's not really maximum. Note that in both of these cases, it is the truth that lambda times the gx is zero. So either lambda needs to be zero or g needs to be zero, right? So either we are inside the potato we are just disregarding this constraint, or we are on the boundary, which means gx is zero, and then we need lambda to find out whether this f and g are actually pointing in the same direction. So this, what I've just shown you, was some intuition why the following theorem should hold. The theorem is called Karush-Kuhn-Tucker conditions or theorem. And it says that if we want to maximize function f given an inequality constraint gx is larger than zero, then we inspect all points of the Lagrangian. And if there was a constraint maximum, the maximum which fulfills all these inequality constraints, then in this point, the gradient with respect to all the variables of the Lagrangian is zero, and the following condition holds. The following conditions are that the Lagrange multiplier is larger or equal to zero, the constraint holds, and one of them is actually zero, right? So either this or this needs to be zero. So either we are on the boundary, in which case the lambda multiplier is an important number, or we are inside the potato, not on the boundary, but inside the space, in which case the lambda must be zero. So the corresponding multiplier is just switched off. These were the necessary conditions. However, it's also similarly to the unconstrained case, you can say, okay, if there is a maximum, then the first derivative needs to be zero. But if the function also has a second derivative and this second derivative is negative, then you know that this point actually was a maximum, right? So these were the sufficient conditions, and it can also be shown that the sufficient conditions exist in this case. So specifically, when you find the point where the derivation is zero and the following condition holds, and these condition holds, then what we have found is actually a maximum. So these will be the sufficient conditions, right? So they are necessary, and these conditions are also sufficient in case where the objective which we want to optimize is a concave function for maximization or a convex function for minimization. That's what we use the SGD settings in anyway, so that's fine. And the inequality constraint are continuous differentiable convex functions, and the equality constraints are affine functions, which means they are linear within offsets. So affine is what we have been doing all the time, right? X times W plus bias. It won't surprise you that we will use this theorem exactly in this situation. So when searching for the constraint optimum, we will just look for the point where the derivation is zero and the following condition holds. And because we will have fulfilled these conditions, we know that that will be the solution. So this is what we will do. Similarly to SGD, once again, we just try to solve the unconstrained optimization problem, but this time we also need to fulfill some additional conditions, and these are these Karush-Kuhn-Tucker conditions. So now let's show how to use it on our problems. What we want to do is we want to minimize the size of the weights. Given that we want the model, or given that we want all the points to have a distance of at least one from the decision boundary. So these are the constraints. So we make the constraint, and we have one constraint for every one training example. So we will have as many multipliers, as many constraints as there are training data. And then we want to minimize this value, and we talked about maximization. So we will try to maximize the following equation, minus one half times the length size of the weight squared, plus the Lagrange multiplier times the gx, the inequality constraint. We can just change the sign because we just want the gradient of this to be zero, so we don't really care whether it's positive or negative. So that's why how we arrived at this. And this constraint, that's just like the constraint need to be equal or greater to zero, so we just update it into this case. So now we have the Lagrangian. So we compute the derivative with respect to W and to bias. So with respect to W, I don't know if you remember, but this yxi, that's just phi xi t times W, right, plus bias. So when computing the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to W, then what we get? Well, we get W for this first part. That's why we had this square, and that's why we had this one half, minus sum over I A I T I. And then here, when we compute the derivative with respect to W, then we just get phi X I right? We want this to be zero. So from this, we get this first condition, which tells us that the weights will be a sum of ai ti phi xi. Then we'll also compute the gradient of the Lagrangian with respect to the bias. The only place where the bias appears is this. So we get just the minus sum of ai di times 1, right? The gradient of the derivative of beta with respect to beta, which results in this second condition. Now we take these equations or these constraints and put them back to the original Lagrangian, right? So we use this and put it here and here. And we will also use the fact that this sum is zero. And we will get the following equation that we want, which we want to minimize, which is the sum over all the Lagrangian factors minus 1/2 of the sum over I, sum over j of ai, aj, ti, tj, and then the kernel of the xi and xj. With respect to some constraints, specifically, when we want to find the minimum of the constraint problem, it needs to fulfill the KKT conditions, which means that the AI level multipliers will need to be non-negative. The constraint needs to be fulfilled, and one of them needs to be zero. So let's look at this interesting condition. So or maybe let's look at it a bit later. Once we get a new point during the test phase or during the evaluation phase, then we will compute the predictions by computing the phi x times w plus bias. We already know that this w is the sum over ai ti phi xi, right? So the final prediction is this. It's sum over all the data, ai, ti, the kernel, right? The kernel is just this, between x and xi plus bias. Now we can look at this interesting thing. So either ai is zero. When ai is zero, then this data plays no role in the prediction whatsoever. So we don't need to use it during prediction, right? It's definitely fine just to sum up over the examples with non-zero AIs, right? Because using an example which has a zero coefficient, that's not really necessary. But if the AI is non-zero, it needs to be positive actually in this case, then we know that the point is on the boundary, which means this ti y xi is 1, which means all the interesting points which are used in this sum are the ones which are on the decision boundary. However, there are not so many of these points. So that's a good sign, right? Even if this is a non-parametric method, we don't need to remember the whole training data. It is enough just to remember the points which are on the decision boundary. For 2D, it was just 3 points. So independently on the number of points which we got on input, even if there will be millions of them, we would just remember 3 of them. And the trained model would consist of 3 numbers, right? Of course, once the dimensionality of the input space increases, this number of points also increases. But generally, if the inputs are d dimensional, then d plus 1 points are enough to fully specify the separating hyperplane. which is good. And these are the only ones which we need for prediction. So these points on the boundary, they are called the support vectors, and that they are the reason of the name of the approach, the support vector machines, right, which are the machines which only need this support vector to operate. So once we trained it, we only keep the part of the training data which had these non-zero Lagrange coefficients, and during prediction, that are the only ones which we actually use. Yep. Are there any questions? Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that I don't have a nice way how to interpret these phis, but the good thing about kernels that you don't actually need to think too much about them. Like, they are there for the technical part, or to actually like realize that there probably exists some mappings. But if you know what the kernel does by itself, then it's fine that you are not really sure how these phis look like. Like, especially for the RBF kernel, it's not difficult to realize what this does, right? This just tells you how far X and Ys are with the distribution of a Gaussian, right? So if you are really, these things are the same, well, they both get, they get like one, which means like they are really the closest, they are really like completely similar, and the further farther they these X and Ys are, the smaller number, the smaller similarity you get. So this is nothing unusual, but these phis which correspond to this kernel, they are extremely nasty, they are even infinite dimensional, so it's difficult to think about them. So I don't think it's that important to have an idea of how these phis are completely constructed. It's better to get an understanding of what these kernels actually are, like what they do, how they operate on these inputs. For the RBF kernel, they just measure the distance with it and then decrease the weight exponentially with the second power of the distance, and the polynomial kernels, they compute the scalar products in like using the quadratic features. So this thing just like for the polynomial kernels, I think thinking about the phis is probably fine, right? Because what this is it's a scalar product in the space of all the combinations of D input features from the input. So I'm not even sure if I answered your question, but personally, I don't have like any better intuition behind these phis. I will draw you some numbers, draw you some pictures before the next lecture of how we can really visualize these kernels, but usually people look at the kernels instead of the phi mappings themselves. Great, thanks. Some other questions, ideas? So this lecture was a bit technical, and the second one will be as well. However, the support vector machines are an important algorithm which still can be useful nowadays, especially if you don't have enough data. Right, the neural networks are there for the rescue if you have enough data, but if you don't, then using the RBF kernels can be beneficial because it can provide a rich representation, rich nonlinear representation of the input without actually needing any data to train. Like, it's like an unsupervised representation. So even nowadays, using SVMs might be useful. So it's an interesting thing to actually know of. Yeah. So if there are any other questions, then by all means, please ask them. Well, I will stop the lecture now. This is exactly where we ended on the Czech lecture as well, and we will go through the rest of the slides on the next lecture. So if there are no questions, then by all means, don't hesitate to go home and enjoy your cup of coffee or something. But if you still have additional questions, then please, you can ask. Seen some people try to unmute their mics, but I couldn't hear anything. It seems it's like that. Okay, so if there are no questions, thank you for your attention. Let's meet again on Wednesday on the practicals. And by the way, if you don't know it, you can also send the private messages on Piazza. So if you want something, you don't need to write to everybody else. It's fine just to write a private note, which you can do so just by pressing the new post and then selecting just the instructors as the addressees of it. So you can also write me a personal email. However, there is also David answering the question, so you will probably get the answer faster if you just use Piazza. There is a question in the chat. So why did we change this this objective function from the maximum of 1 over w to minimum of this value? And the reason is just mathematical convenience. At this point, changing this formulation doesn't change the best margin. For the linear regression, I was acting like, oh, we need to know why this loss function has a 2 there and why is it important, because the loss function changes the algorithm or changes the model which you arrive to. But here in this situation, it does not, because the only important thing what we need to do is we need to maximize this 1 over distance. So in other words, we just need the smallest distance at all as possible. So the values which maximize this also minimize this this equation. Doesn't really matter, and we did it just because we know that once we will compute the Lagrangian, it will be the most useful to have this this second order here. If we did it differently, then the math would come out not as nice. So contrary to what we did in the regression problems, the choice of this objective function, like the bottom one or the above one, it doesn't influence the result, right? So we can choose whatever is convenient for us actually. So that's why we did it this time. We just wanted things to be convenient. And generally, like, the idea is that after computing the derivative, we want 1w to be left there, right? Which allows us to get this first constraint, this one, so nicely. Otherwise, if it would be there only with a 1, it would be like 0 is something. And if we would just leave 1 over w, then there would be the w squared. So this is the way of getting the linear expression for w. You're welcome. So if there are, yep, great. And that's an interesting question. The question is whether the single batch with betas is related to the way how we used single batch before. And the question is that it is. Generally, whatever we do in the primal formulation, like whatever batches we use in the primal formulation, then automatically tell us how we should update the betas. And generally, if we do the primal update with the weights, which updates some indices B1 to BB, or which computes the gradient with respect to some batch of examples, then if we have this one batch, then if we perform the same update with the same batch in the dual formulation, it will update the betas corresponding exactly to these examples which were in the batch. Right, because during the primal update, we multiply the gradient by the feature vector corresponding to that example. And if the betas correspond to these examples, well, then that are exactly the betas which will change. So if we update single beta, it is the same as saying that we are updating the gradient using a simple batch example. If we update all the betas, for example, it means we are updating using the full gradient. And if we are updating some subset of betas, then it would correspond to an update which would use this exact subset of training examples to compute the gradient. So it's 15:39, so I think that's it's time for the questions to stop. Thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy a nice Monday, and see you all on Wednesday. Bye-bye.